you can rely on Atlas Butler for all of your plumbing and drain service needs. Our expert plumbers and drain specialists can take care of anything, from a broken water heater to a clogged drain. One call truly does it all.
Atlas Butler is built to keep you comfortable, and our plumbing services are no exception. Call today, get it fixed today. That's our pledge to you.
Atlas Butler is at your service. Call 1-800-FURNACE.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Julian Ng and Kusu Chuang. We have an exciting lineup for you this morning, but more importantly, it's Friday, and that signals the start of a weekend.
Yes, it is.
For all of us.
Yeah.
Except those of us who work 5.5 days.
I work 7 days a week.
Oh, four days. Oh, you do?
I don't work weekends.
Never have no rest for the wicked, as they say. No rest for the wicked.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So anyway, we do have an exciting lineup, and this includes a breakfast grill today with Iqbal Khan from Fajar Capital, and he's going head-to-head with Ibrahim Sani. So that's at 8 a.m. And after the 8:30 news, we take a look at the Philippines, as we did yesterday. Yesterday, we looked at the dimension of the media.
Have you ever been to the Philippines, Sharad?
I, in fact, spent 7 months on a fellowship there, and a research fellowship.
Right.
I was based in Quezon City.
And what's it like anyway?
And what is it that you try and sound British?
Yeah.
I don't know if you want.
I don't see the connection.
I know. You could try to sound Filipino.
Weren't they an American colony?
They were, in fact.
They were. They still are, right? In a way.
Not under Duterte, sure.
Well, not under
Yeah. 400 years under the Spanish, and then via Mexico, and then 50 years under the Americans. Yeah. So that's their colonial history.
So you've got to change your accent.
I can't do Spanish very well.
It's a lovely country. I mean, it's if you like archipelagos, if you like...
Really, I love archipelagos.
Yeah, and it's
so
beautiful.
Yeah. We're living in one, actually.
Well, kind of.
Well, Malaysia's not really an archipelago. Really, no, it doesn't. Yeah. It's not like Indonesia.
Did you ever go to the Sulawesi side and do the whole Wallace Trail thing? Did you ever do that?
Well, that's Indonesia again.
Well, correct, but it's only a bit south, right?
A little bit south.
You know what I mean?
Your geography, obviously geographically challenged. No,
very.
The Philippines, I thought, what apart from that, is of extraordinary intellectual tradition as well. So if you have one of the oldest universities in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, is over 400 years old because it's associated with the Catholic Church. But UP Diliman and Ateneo University, among some of the top universities in the world. And
No kidding. Higher ranked than Malaysians?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and, the quality of the scholarship, that I know in the social sciences is very high. The quality of writing, just the intellectual... heft that some of the individuals and academics in the Philippines have. I mean, they just have international names, and so for me, it was an exciting time because I bought a lot of books. I went to a lot of seminars.
Well, this was a long time ago, was it?
It was about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Achieved in 7 months what people would take a lifetime to do.
Now you're mocking me.
No,
like I said, well, mocking will get you nowhere.
Well, in terms of your literary consumption, right? Because obviously, you're on a fellowship, you do read a lot.
Yeah, you do read a lot. Also, I think my remit was actually to have conversations with people, and
I would love to go somewhere just to have conversations with people.
Yeah, and I had a wonderful
brilliant.
Year.
Don't you have enough of that in morning?
Yeah, true.
It's not real conversation.
True.
But it is conversation. It's just that we are having conversations with
among ourselves,
people, right? So, kind of change the terms of that conversation. Also, I think Malaysia looks very different standing in
from
Manila.
Outside, right?
You think of the kinds of intractable problems that the Philippines has over poverty
versus what we have
over the political elite. Yeah, I mean, there, people who promote, say, democracy don't necessarily promote social equality. And in Malaysia, there's a kind of alignment with both, right? At least you need to constantly invoke social equality in this country. Whereas there, you know, you don't see that kind of social mobility. You know, you don't really have stories of people, you know, whose parents were farmers, and this, you know, and then the next generation they're lawyers and doctors and engineers. You haven't had that equalizing pressure and dynamic there as much as you've had here. And so, you know, when you see that,
because really the government's there as well. They've been a bit not dodgy, but they've had, you know, lots of regime changes and stuff, right?
Well, it's not just that. I think it's also they're not committed. They're rotating a system of rotating families, you know, that control the Filipino system. And it, you know, and Duterte, interestingly enough,
he's not one of the incumbent families.
Well, he is what they call a tradpol, a traditional politician, but he's from one of the minor families. And, you know, he's not like the Marcoses or the Cojuangcos.
He's an outsider.
Yeah, Cojuangcos are the people associated with, because the Aquino family, right? And then they have their race issues, but they work race and ethnicity out in very different ways than we
really
do in Malaysia.
Yeah.
So, you know, say the Cojuangcos would be it's a name that's obviously a truncation or it's a putting together of a Chinese name, right? You can imagine Cojuangco, you know, and so these are Filipinos, Spanish Filipinos, the Zobels, the Ayala Zobels, apparently.
Big
family, big property owners. They apparently still speak Spanish. They have endowed a prize in Spanish.
Actually, sounds fascinating.
Literature.
I'd love to go there. Actually, I've never been there.
You've never been to the Philippines? Jillian, have you been
there?
Neither
have I.
Actually. Oh, it's really worth a visit.
All the headlines that we read from here, you know, in terms of all the fracas and stuff down south, you know, it's like a troubled nation kind of thing.
Well, you know, most nations in South Asia are troubled to some extent. But then there's, but you know,
what Chuang is trying to say is that there is a lot of bad press about getting kidnapped and there's a ransom industry going on.
But it ain't necessarily so, is it?
Well, no, I don't think it touches the daily lives of people. But you do see, I mean, it's very Americanized in many ways. Lots of guns around.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, then shoot a few. Well,
what would you say is the first place that we should go to, like an entry point into the Philippines?
Well, obviously Manila, but Manila's not the most exciting city. I think a lot of tourists go through Manila to some of the beach resorts.
But they're very commercialized, right? These kind of
places? They're all beach resorts. Are beach resorts anyways, whether it's Phuket or whatever. You know, Langkawi, they're all resorts. But, I mean, to access the intellectual life, maybe you have to spend a bit of time. You need to know what's going on.
I like your recommendations for travel, like access to intellectual life. Is that how you define your travels?
Like that. Actually, we should all do a travel show like that, right? Just go there and talk to poets and writers, actors, you know.
Absolutely. You know, one of the most interesting...
we're not taking the mickey, Sean. I'm serious.
I believe you, because I believe very much in conversation. Manila used to produce a magazine called a journal called Solidarity. It was a Southeast Asian whites journal, led by a novelist who still has a shop in Manila, a bookstore in Manila. You know, in 1969, Dr. Mahathir wrote a piece
in solidarity. Really?
Explaining the whole kind of May 13th thing, the return. It would have been 70 with the return to democracy, and the reflection on Malaysian politics was very interesting. And I interviewed the editor, and I said, "So, you know, how did you come to get this article from Mahathir?" He says, "Well, you know, at that point, Mahathir was a nobody.
He's a nobody, right?
He was a nobody."
Malay Dilemma was around about that time as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was written while he was, as it were, in exile from UMNO. He'd been forced out of UMNO.
Did you get a copy of the article, actually? Quite fascinating.
It is. It's called The Problems of Democratic Nation Building. And I mean, not that he's so bullish on democracy. In fact, he isn't.
But
he explains why they returned, the pressures that pushed Malaysia back towards democracy. But his overarching concerns about nation building, and that had to do with social equality and stuff. And so not so much. And, you know... a fascinating intellectual tradition that was in Manila, but kind of eclipsed by, in some ways, its it's kind of downward trend in terms of the narrative economic that we success.
Because, you know, when I talked to the World Bank guy, I mean, so, you know, citing him from a couple of years ago, this conversation, he was saying that the Philippines in the 60s and the 70s was quite a prosperous place. And then through mismanagement, it became kind of like the Zimbabwe of Asia.
Well, you know, this is the same story for Burma. You know, the University of Rangoon was the top university in South Asia. In the 50s, all the major regional conferences were held in Yangon, in what is now Yangon, but then Rangoon. And so, the intellectual strength, the fact that, you know, Burmese were, you know, I mean, Utan, one of the the Secretary General of the UN from Asia came from Burma.
We have a road name after him in Malaysia.
Absolutely.
I mean, he's Jalan Utan, that big, right?
I'm sure there's a story for us in Malaysia, because obviously right now we're in like a kind of like a halcyon period. But you know, through mismanagement, we could well be
absolutely
on that path.
You know, reversals are really possible. And you see evidence of reversals
all
in this region.
World. Yeah.
You know, and today, and I was just talking to somebody, they're collecting books for Rangoon University. They're trying to, you know, the destruction of their educational institutions by a class of, you know, of military leaders, some of them very close to people like Lee Kuan Yew, like Ne Win was very close to Lee Kuan Yew, who systematically destroyed, you know. But, okay, it's a much more complex story than one that's really worth telling, at least in terms of the people involved. So, yeah, I would say go to Manila. Even if you don't get to access the intellectual life immediately.
Well, I tell you,
the beaches are beautiful.
You give me a couple of numbers to call, Sean. I'll say, I know George Sharad Chittarajan.
I spent 2 weeks in Zamboanga City, just kind of hanging out.
That's not Africa, right?
No, that's in southern Philippines.
Right.
Oh, my God. Chuang, your geography. Zamboanga.
It's appalling.
Yeah, you know.
What's Zamboanga?
The south has beautiful food.
Wow.
A lot, much more vegetables than you get in the north, you know, with the sausilogs and sausilogs.
You know what? A few months ago, I went traveling, right? And I came across this this quite young German girl. She was traveling the world by herself. She's only 20 years old. And she was training to be a teacher. And I said to her, how long have you been traveling? She said, I've been traveling for 6 months. I've been to Australia, New Zealand, all of Southeast Asia. Then I asked her, what was the most memorable part of your trip? And she said, the southern Philippines. And I said, are you serious? I thought that place, and I reeled off headlines about, you know, beheadings and
Jolo and
Jolo, etc. And she said, no. Yeah, and she said the best part of her trip was the 3 weeks that she spent in southern Philippines, going from island to island, interacting with the villagers and staying in their houses.
Oh, I didn't do that.
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, but you know, so
it is. It's a lovely. People are very nice. I kept being mistaken for an American soldier on furlough, like, you know, I was African American or something, and because people
because you look that way, right?
So, well, you know, the Philippines, and I think it's very interesting. The name of the person who's being interviewed on Current Affairs, he's from the Philippines. His name is Ranjit, because there are a lot of North Indians in the Philippines. Some of them associated with the...
Russell Peters was right. There's too many Chinese and Indians all over the world. One day we'll all be brown.
But you know
gray.
What they don't recognize so much are South Indians. And so that's only changing with the BPOs and the call centers, which are now being managed by South Indians. So
In the Philippines.
And so I'm constantly mistaken because they can't figure out my complexion and my look of me.
See, that's funny because sometimes when I go to Europe, I get mistaken for being Spanish. I can't imagine why.
Well, what part is what kind of
the
Spanish
part in my imagination?
Well, okay. So on Current Affairs, I say having a look at Duterte and how he's captured the popular imagination in the Philippines. Also on the Property Show today with Azura Rahman, we're looking at the best financing packages out there for you to purchase your home. And as a guest, they have Ross Cheong of iMoney. So that's on the Property Show coming up at 9:30. We have a bit of time to look at the results of the polls that we had yesterday.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, Sam, I think a gazillion people, it seems, voted. Well, about 86, really. And 12% said to the question, are you more persuaded by an argument or message peppered with swear words? 12% said yes in any context. 38% said yes, but only in informal context. And 50% said never.
So our listeners are actually split in the middle. To me, this is a 50-50 thing.
It's a 50-50 thing.
Yeah, 50. I'm not persuaded by swearing at the other 50, maybe.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a that's a nice spread, I think. You know, you
so we're not as puritanical as we seem to be.
Well, and or given to the emotive kind of gesture.
Yeah.
Because when you swear, it's all about the emotion, the emphasis. That's right. It's really not about the argument, is it? Well, yes. Also in the news, very quickly, extreme weather. Hurricane Matthew has left over 100 people dead in Haiti, and it's been upgraded to a Category 4 storm and is heading towards the state of Florida in the USA.
Wow.
That's the other thing about the Philippines.
Yeah.
You do want to give it a miss during hurricane season. I was there, and a hurricane hit Manila, the worst in 12 years. I had no idea what a hurricane was until I experienced it myself.
What was it like anyway?
It was scary. It was scary, you know. And
you got blown about and stuff, didn't you?
People do, and people die. And I was very lucky. I'd already, you know, I was going to go down south to Palawan, to Puerto Princesa. And so I took a ferry. But, you know, a ferry in choppy waters is also a bit of a scary proposition. Yeah. Well, we're going to come back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run with Kusu Chuang, Julian Ng, and myself, Sherrod Kutin. You're listening to Jumping Jack Flash. So you've just heard Jumping Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones, which reminds me of Whoopi Goldberg for some reason. Because there was a movie associated with the song?
I think so, yeah, I think so.
That's
think
it, so. That's yeah. it. It's now 21 minutes past 6. And just a note, there were some other things in the news today apart from Hurricane Matthew. Pakistan government has closed a loophole allowing so-called honor killings perpetrators of honor killings to go free. Now, new legislation means that honor killings will demand a mandatory life sentence.
Yeah, this is, I think, really good news. And I'm just wondering, because I don't have a lot of background on this, Sherrod, but what was their view on this before this law was implemented? Were they quite condoning? Or did they have one eye shut on this kind of thing?
Well, I think that there was a cultural issue. And one of the ways in which a perpetrator could get away was that the victim's family would forgive them. And so, you know, that was part of it. But, you know, we've also had honor killings within families. I don't know how that worked. If you remember that blogger, that Pakistani blogger who was murdered because of... she had married somebody that the family didn't approve of, but it was discovered that she was not only murdered, but she was raped before she was murdered. So this is, you know, this really ugly culture, misogynistic, anti-women, you know, that perpetuates this idea that families have this control, especially over women, and that, you know, that they're justified in these actions.
So this is good that they have finally acted on something that they felt previously had to be addressed.
Right. Interesting also in the news is a story about a writer and a human rights activist who's been sentenced to 6 years imprisonment in Iran for writing a story about stoning. What's more amazing about this is that the story hasn't even been published. But Golrokh Ibrahimi Irai, I think is how you pronounce the name, she's actually facing 6 years in prison.
It's a female.
Well, I think so. And she is. And she's been convicted of insulting Islamic sanctities and spreading propaganda against the system. Again,
traces of Minority Report on this. Like you're arrested before the crime is committed.
She's actually, I'm assuming she wrote the story
crime
just hasn't been published.
Well, assuming it's a crime in the first place, write a story about something.
Yeah, exactly. And being critical. Right. I mean, critical commentary on things like the culture of stoning people as a form of a capital punishment. And, you know, the question of, you know, Iran, since the Iranian Revolution, what kind of space it's had for dissent. I mean, this is another country,
with a long intellectual
tradition.
Which had an age in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Well,
and
not
and
also, in the light. I mean, the Shah of Iran was a complete despot.
The period before him.
Tin pot dictator.
Yeah. And also now, I think, interesting times for them because they have normalized their relationships with the United States and now they're going to, you know, be able to freely sell oil into the world. This kind of development is very unsettling because, you know, it's really reflective of these commodity-dependent nations who can get their validity from a commodity and making a lot of money getting a lot of power out of that, but ignoring everything else.
Yeah.
And when The price of oil again, you know, falls down to $20 or $30. You know, then
does that mean that loses its identity, right?
Maybe, you know, because you draw so much power from the price of a commodity, and you don't place importance on anything else. It leaves the country in a lurch. When you don't have the kind of freedoms and creativity to think, the kind of innovation.
Correct. It's a bit like having a big job when during your working life, and then when you retire, you lose your values and, well, value and credibility.
Well, I mean, one of the lessons for authoritarian regimes in Asia, in Southeast Asia in particular, is that if you want to kind of go up the value chain, you need to empower your citizens. You want to promote creativity independent thinking. But you're right, Julian. So what happens with a country that doesn't care about the modern economy as such? They just keep pumping the wealth out of the ground. Yeah. What incentive is there for them to look at their citizens as a resource that need to be invested in, need to be protected, that need to be nurtured?
Right now you can see that the Bruneians and the Middle East and the Saudis, you know, who have made a lot of money from oil, but they care very little for everything else. So they're very authoritarian regimes. But you can say the same thing about China. China is so rich, but at the expense of its people who don't really have much room to flourish.
Well, I think the portrait of China has to be drawn more with greater nuance. It's such a complex country.
I think so.
I think on-the-ground realities are really they're not sufficiently captured by the idea that they're just simply authoritarian.
Yeah, because I'd like to spend some time in China, just like how you did in the Philippines. You know, 7 months, 8 months, go talk to people. And you're right. I mean,
some
research.
I think that would be a very good experience.
Yeah, I would love to do that.
But, you know, something has to be said about what China has done to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, right, compared to where they were in the 80s or before. It really hits at your own personal beliefs about democracies, and here is an authoritarian country that is so dictatorial and, you know, decides where the economy goes and decide who is rich and who isn't, but has managed to lift all these people out of poverty. It really makes you think, right? Hey, is this the right way to do it?
Or, interestingly, Singapore, when it came out to its 50 year celebration, Kishore Mahbubani penned an essay saying that Singapore was one of the great experiments of the 20th century in terms of, you know, social indicators. And I think it was...
And he's by and large, right?
It's a tiny little city-state. I mean, how does it compare to the Chinese story?
But it's an experiment. He was right in saying that it's an experiment.
Well, he was also trying to justify, I think, the authoritarian nature of Singapore society. Yeah. And I think this is
a gamble. But for them, I think if you had to use a model, for example, take Singapore, the Singapore model, to run your country, isn't it a gamble? Because you would then have to look for a benign dictator, right? How do you start going about looking for that?
Yeah, well, so this is it, right? Yeah. So the whole thing hinged on the idea that Lee Kuan Yew was somehow kind of philosopher king who was not corrupt, and all of which I think can be scrutinized more deeply. But the point is that those arguments are made, you know, performance... in terms of lifting people out of poverty, become a way of justifying authoritarian rule. But China can't live on that narrative any longer. It needs to rethink how it's going, what the future is going to be, if it wants to be fully kind of modern and embrace all the kinds of developments in the modern world.
I think China is really leveraging on 1.3 billion people to promote and to secure their ascendancy, because they are in control of this 1.3. And using that, I guess, to make a lot of money and to gain a lot of economic power out of that. I mean, look at a company like Didi Guaidi, who recently pushed Uber out of China. And the owner of Didi Guaidi today is called the Uber Slayer, right? But would they have been able to do that if not for that big populace that they have? Did they have creativity and the innovative gumption to kick something like Uber out of China? Not that Uber is also the most innovative country, innovative company in the world. They just did the right thing and was at the right place at the right time, right? I don't think Malaysia or Singapore can be a country which can set up a Didi Kuaidi just like that.
Well, okay, yeah. you know, just very quickly, also in the news, an artwork thought to be a Dutch by Dutch artist Frans Hal that's sold for £8.5 million has been declared a forgery. Lots of forgeries around. But you know, for me,
I saw that story from a few days ago. In fact, they found a couple of Van Goghs as well.
That were forgery. Yeah, apparently, there's a man out there, or a woman, or a group of people creating these extraordinary forgeries.
I think they deserve every penny of that. I mean, if you could recreate a classic masterpiece.
Okay, we'll be right back because we've got the first bulletin of the day with Nadia Abdulaziz, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Walk Like a Man by Grand Funk Railroad, a throwback from, I think, the deep 70s or 60s.
Yeah, they were a big band in the 70s.
Right, and that's Kusu Chuang you're hearing, and Julian also with me. Julian Ng, sorry, I don't know what I did with your name there. And I'm Sharad Kutin. And welcome to The Morning Run. It's now 40 minutes past 6, and apparently, guys, there's a word for buying books and not reading them. And for somebody who could be accused of this, I want to kind of have a, you know, my defense later.
Confession time.
There is a Japanese word for it. Sonduku.
It's not the game, by the way.
Yeah, which is Sudoku, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, I'm guilty of that crime. I love going to bookstores and buying lots of books. And then I've got books from the 80s, which I haven't read yet. I mean, that's how despicable I am.
But maybe it's a question of timing. What I mean is not timing, which is different, which is that you buy a book, you know one day you'll be able to pick it off your shelf, and then you do. So you can buy it, and then 6 months later when you read it...
My issue is time just basically.
Why do we buy books then?
Because I just love the look of it. You know what? The first thing I do when I pick up a book, I smell it. I love the smell of books.
It's kind of like a smartness through osmosis, right? You feel
You
have these nice-looking books on your shelves. It makes you a little bit smarter.
But I've stopped buying books. You know why? Because they take up too much space. They weigh too much. I know.
But it doesn't smell. Remember, they tried to resolve this problem with a kind of like scratch and sniff patch.
Not the same thing.
You know,
thing.
So you basically get the smell of paper and that sensation.
Serious?
Yeah.
They're doing that?
No, well, they did in the past to kind of resolve the problem of this dimension of the pleasure of book reading, which is about the paper smell of paper.
Yeah, you know when you flip a page and you crinkle the page in your fingers, that's an amazing feeling.
I don't have any such romantic affinity, so I just I have no qualms about putting all my books on the Kindle and carrying my 100 or 200 books with me wherever I go and reading them whenever I feel like it. But, you know, I do that for the Kindle. I practice this Sudoku on Kindle, and I have tons of books in there that I've bought but not read.
Okay, so we're going to tweet out a link to the story that has this. But interestingly enough, it begins with an excerpt from that movie that was recently remade, and I'm sort of losing my talk here.
That's
The Great Gatsby. Yeah. Which was written by Fitzgerald. And in it, it has that the guy, the millionaire character,
Gatsby
who has books on his shelves, but they're not...
But he doesn't read them.
He doesn't read them. So they make a point about the fact that he's put them there for show. And But I do believe that some of us who buy books, we do buy them in advance. I mean, I don't have access to a good library as I used to. When I went to NUS in Singapore, I had a great library. I didn't have to buy books because I could always browse this great
but
library.
But it's come to a point
where
I feel bad about buying books because it means I'm depriving somebody else of the pleasure. And then it sits on my bookshelf for ages.
Well, no. I mean, I think book publishers would be very glad... I don't think
you're depriving them. I mean, there are enough copies to go
around. I know. But the thing is, it sits there unread and unloved, you know, a bit like Tabasco sauce in my
pantry.
But
what about your children? I mean, in this room, you're the most reproductive of the lot. In fact, you're the only reproductive individual in this room.
I am quite virile sometimes.
No, I didn't say virile. I said reproductive.
Same thing, Sharad.
No, actually, there's a huge gap between...
You see, Sharad, he wants to...
No, I'm with Sharad here. It's not the same thing.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. So you have children.
I do.
I grew up in a house where we had a room dedicated to books.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And that's something your children will have.
I'd like to make a point because when I grew up in Penang, in our house in Plotikos, I grew up in my father's library. And my father was a serial reader. He used to read 4 or 5 books a day. A week.
Okay.
And my room was the library. And I had the run of the place, right? I had all kinds of stuff all around me, from the I Ching to Tolkien to Sidney Sheldon to
Alistair
McLean.
No wonder you're so wise, Chuang.
I am
you're wise.
You're
so knowledgeable.
I'm wise and reproductive.
And so this is the thing, right? So in creating that space in your house today,
yeah.
you allow your children
no, you're
to
right,
access.
You're right. I should do that, shouldn't I?
And you
I
do. And the fact that you, what you're saying is that you do that, and that has by default,
by
your children will have that.
But you know what?
You know what?
In the last few years, I moved quite a lot because I used to work elsewhere and move in between houses. And it's only when you move house do you realize how much junk you got. And you know, one of the biggest and heaviest items to move around were
books.
My books. Yeah.
Yeah, they're terrible.
And then it made me realize, my goodness, I've got to stop buying books because they're incredibly heavy.
But the things that are really beautiful, I mean, coming back to Kindle, what Kindle does very well is, especially if you're just looking at text, but a lot of the books I have are art books.
I can't do
with
Kindle.
Great images.
Yeah, with those, I mean, with the pictorial. What do they call the comics on Amazon? Graphic novels.
Graphic novels.
Yeah.
How do you do
that? Why don't they just call it comics? With graphic novels,
because they're novels.
They can charge more.
Yeah. I think you can't do a Kindle on that. You've got to buy the real book. But
I disagree because the resolution on the screen brings out the thing.
No, yeah. But you want to hold those books, right? It's like works of art. But
they are.
I think with the other books without pictures, which is the kind that we read normally, like the ones without pictures, right? I may be crucified for saying this, but I think that holding that book is overrated. I mean, you learn so much more from using a Kindle because there is a dictionary that's online connected to Wikipedia.
I can do both, but on my iPad, because you can search, you can do highlight, you can do
convenience.
So Mei Deng, D-H-E-N-G is how she spells her Twitter handle. She says she has a whole stack, and Dr. Fu has also tweeted in, and he's asked, what do you call someone who's downloaded too many podcasts without having time to listen to all of them?
I'm sure they have a Japanese word for that.
I'm sure they have. There's a Japanese word for blogs that go dead.
Supodku.
Supodku?
Yeah, I
support. Oh, nice.
Support, yeah, do you know what I mean?
There you have it. Okay.
But a cunning linguist at the same time.
Well, moving rapidly in the opposite direction from that awful pun, just because we don't want to go there this early on a Friday morning, is the question of books, right? I mean, and libraries. I just wonder how many libraries it's just sometimes because of my own kind of atheistic bent of mind, is like, how many libraries are being built in this country as opposed to religious institutions. I mean, churches or mosques or temples or whatever.
Exactly.
Versus what I think is
the
secular
all,
temple.
You can put them all online. I mean,
yes, and the
religious institution. Switch it on, you press a button, and you've had your communion.
But,
I mean, how nice that.
But
would be.
There's something. There's like the Gutenberg Project online. There are lots of things you can do online. But there is something special in the communion you have with other readers
in
the space
of
the library.
Yeah, I mean, he's a smart
mixing my religious benefits with the secular.
He slipped it in,
so subtly. And in fact, it was so subtle, it should have remained subtle and not been pointed
until
out.
We brought it out.
Yeah, well, what can I do with you guys? Dead loss. But okay, so there it is. We don't have the word for, podcasts that never get listened to. But maybe there's something about our animal nature that when we see good things, we hoard them.
Yeah,
so you kind of,
have you been to
Big Bad Wolf book sale?
Yeah.
I mean, the impulse.
And then you buy a lot of books which don't really read.
Well, again, you're setting up little libraries around, around the country. You have your personal library. Your children can feast off it. If I could allow, and I wouldn't, but my neighbors to come and access my books and they could return it, I would because I have such beautiful books. And, I buy books to the cities I go to when I travel.
Yeah.
And I inscribe.
I remember when I went to New York in the late 90s, and I came back with a whole satchel full of books because, in New York,
you can buy a book for a buck.
Yeah, a buck, 50 cents, and really good books. First editions, it was really great, really good.
Okay,
so from physical locations, libraries and physical locations, there's this other story that we wanted to cover, which is about
Idiots. And this goes is inspired by what happened with the 9 Australians. They've been let off with a warning. Some interesting arguments made by their lawyer, who's, of course, none other than Tan Sri Shafi Abdullah, you know, who said that I this was a trivial matter.
This is the classic storm in a teacup, mountain on a molehill.
Okay, so
I don't think
well, And The Guardian, and somebody who's written to The Guardian, or written for The Guardian, doesn't think so as well. In fact, they cast some serious aspersions on these 9 Australians. Look, Julian, who wrote this piece?
It's by this person called Bridget Delaney, I think. And she's suggesting along the lines of Hyde Park to set up an idiot park for these guys to be able to go there and to do whatever they want without the consequences.
Okay, so this is the title, okay? I've got a solution to the problem of Aussies acting like idiots abroad.
Okay, look, of course they were idiots. They're a bunch of young guys having a lot of beer, attending an F1 race. You're supposed to have a party, you know. And you know what? It's not just the Malaysian flag. I've seen desecrations of the Union Jack at all kinds of sporting events. I mean, Ian Poulter, one of the best golfers in the UK. He makes a sometimes his dress, which is the Union Jack adorned all over it. He makes a mockery of the British flag.
And, I don't think it's about the flag. It's just about not being an idiot.
It's such a bunch of young guys having some beer at an F1 race. You know, we're making them out.
Okay. You're absolutely right. I think Julian, where I agree with Chuang is that's what the F1 is.
It's a
and
party.
In fact, Shafi Abdullah interestingly mentioned the fact that some women at this F1 event were probably less dress than the men were.
Well, it's okay, right?
I mean, that's probably not true, but it's almost true, isn't it?
You know, trackside is 45 degrees centigrade, right? Obviously, the less you wear, the better, but there are
limits. You want to get burned by the sun.
I think there is an overriding factor here. I think, of course, you can make different nuances with the Formula One, but the point about this whole thing is being sensitive to local culture.
When you go
to some place like that, if you went to a place like Iran and you did that, and there are consequences for that,
I think you have to take
the blame for it.
Yeah, of course, horses for courses, right?
Yeah.
But that same weekend was the Ryder Cup weekend at Hazeltine, right? And I saw idiots there with beer cans on their head with the stars and stripes across their caps. I mean, it's just a bunch of guys having fun. Right?
I think the question
this is not about having fun. This is where you draw the line.
These are foreigners. I think the issue is that they were non-Malaysians with the Malaysian flag on their bottoms. I think the other issue
is whether any harm was caused.
No harm, maybe to the eyes and...
Absolutely. I mean, so anyway, this is obviously a discussion that is animating public debate, not just in Malaysia, but all the way in jolly old England.
With the
Guardian. So, well, we're going to be coming back with more business stories after 7 o'clock news because, you know, serious stuff, which you guys are going to lead. And but before that, we'll listen to the amazing voice of Aretha Franklin and her song Think on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.